Ruby Ridge, and then Waco, Oklahoma City. We have this big crescendo building up, all these different events, building up to the first World Trade Center bombing in, was it 93? Supposed to knock over one of the two towers at least. And we worked our way up to TWA 800, got past that. I'm sure I've forgotten one or two. And then 9/11 and others. There have been many things. They've all been perpetrated by basically the same group. We have a rare opportunity through the good graces of Ole Damgaard, who is with us tonight, to hear something that you've never heard before about the Oklahoma City bombing. This is very interesting. It was really a pivotal event in many ways. Now, I'll never forget, you remember the axiom, the best and most accurate news usually and often comes within the first few hours of one of these big headline-grabbing events. And I remember hearing in Oklahoma City how the police were in that building, what was still left of it, and they were reporting live unexploded bombs located in the building, the Mura building. And they shut that down real quick. A lot of people died who were involved with that. One of the, there was a black officer, a police officer involved. I've forgotten his name, but he was a hero. He stood very firm on what he saw and encountered there, and they killed him off. They do that all the time. Life means nothing to the controllers. Never forget that. Ole Damgaard, are you there?
I sure am, Jeff.
Thanks for getting up early. How are you?
Good, thank you. I feel very honored to be part of this exposure, and I can just say that Cody here, who's going to join us in a few minutes, is someone who approached me about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
As many of you listeners know, I've spent some 35 years of my life trying to expose state-sponsored terrorism, false flags, black ops, track down assassins, and so on.
Sure.
Just as a one-man band, but trying to really make a difference. And about a year ago, I was approached by Cody Snodgrass, who had this incredible story about how he had been offered to do the Oklahoma City bomb, turned it down, and then turned from an asset, an independent contractor working under the CIA, into a liability. And so I thought it was absolutely amazing. I tried everything I could to support him morally to step forward with this information because
sure.
I know the risks he's taken. And here we are a year later, and it's finally time to really let it go out there.
It's a risk that, as I mentioned, you have so many people who have paid that ultimate price for trying to tell the truth and be honest human beings, American patriots. Whatever country they live in, it doesn't matter. Those who are running the show continue to eradicate life as if it means nothing to them. And in point of fact, it doesn't mean anything to them. It's a convenience to be used. That's how many of them view it, and that's how they use it. And we are very honored to have with us Mr. Cody Snodgrass, and he is standing by, I believe, right now. Are you there, Cody?
Yes, sir. I sure am. How are you guys doing?
We're good. Say hi, Ole.
Hi. Good to be here with you, Cody.
All right. Now, Cody, I've got a spelling on your last name. You want to spell it for me to make sure I have it correct?
Yeah, it's a strange name. It's S-N-O-D-G-R-E-S.
Snodgrass.
Yes, sir.
What is the derivation of that? What's it mean? Most names have some kind of a meaning.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like, you know, Cary Snodgrass. That's the actor that most people know, and that's a G-R-A-S-S, and I really don't know.
It's, well, Snodgrass probably means truth teller in some dialect somewhere.
Well, that's what we're doing here tonight, that's for sure.
That's right. As we look back on Oklahoma City, on the OKC bombing, do you spend much time, I know you're doing a lot now, but during the years that have been intervening since then, did you spend much time tracking it, following it, or did you try to put it out of your consciousness as much as you could and get on with your life?
Well, no, it was something when I was offered that job to bomb that building, I immediately was revulsed by it. I didn't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I told contractor that was there that did it, I just told him, you know, I'll just tell you the story. It was in October of 1994, and Harold Leonard, he's deceased now.
Uh-huh.
But I need to say something before we start.
Yeah, let's take it wherever you want. Go ahead.
Yeah, I always make a statement with Olay and whoever else we're talking with. In 1982, they had the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. That's the IIPA, and it's U.S. Code Title 50, Sections 421, 426. And it says the disclosure of a U.S. government operative's identity is illegal only if it is done intentionally and with knowledge that the government is still actively maintaining a cover for such operatives. So when we talk here, I'm not going to mention anybody's names still operational, but the people I'm talking about are will mention by name are dead. And so the reason
I
do that, if you recall that FBI officer John Kiriakou, he was sentenced in January 2013 to 30 months in federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was he violated this act, mm-hmm. the IIP Act, by disclosing an operative's name in that RDI program, the CI's Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation Program. So
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We don't want to do anything like that. We're just going to talk about the people that are gone and dead and explain the story from there.
Very good. All right, what were you doing, minding your own business when this offer was made to you? Give me the background on that.
Well, I've been in Black Ops for a long time, almost 20 years. I was about to retire. In fact, I did retire in 1995 in March.
Can you name the company you were with? Which one? You don't have to.
I was an independent contractor in
okay.
Black Ops.
Very good.
One of my civilian covers, I was a petroleum geophysicist for Amoco Production Company. But
very good cover.
Oh, yeah, it was a real good cover. But I was working on my master's degree in physics down in Texas,
mm-hmm.
and we got to fly the space shuttle simulator down there and all that stuff. But I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and worked there in the early 80s, and then that was our cover for operations over in Arkansas when the Clintons were there and everything. But you fast forward through all those, and we're up to 1994 in October, and Harold Leonard called me one day, and he said, we have a job for you. We went out in the woods and get away from all surveillance and everything, and he said, we have a job for you. And I said, what country are we going to? I thought it was going to be in Saudi Arabia or something. And he said, no, it's here in the States. And so I said, what kind of job is it? And he said, it's an EOD job. It's an explosives and demolitions job.
Right.
And I said, what kind of op is it? And he said, it's a building. He said, it's a federal building. And I said, what? And I said, which one? And he said, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. And he had a backpack, purple and black backpack, that had $500,000 in cash in it. And he said, there's half here, we'll pay you half when the job's done, and you can have whatever you need, you know, to get it done. And I was getting towards the end of my career, and I had severe PTSD, and I'd actually died in the hospital twice back in September 18th through the 22nd in 1991 in Project Slammer. It was a covert program. But I was getting to the end of my career, and I couldn't take this stuff anymore. I was having bad dreams at night. And I just told him, I said, this is our own country, and I'm not going to do it. There's no way I'm going to do this. And so I turned down that job, and that was a point at which I turned from an asset into a liability.
Immediately. Do you think he was wired, even though you went out in the middle of the woods?
No.
Mm-hmm.
I knew him for a long time. We've done several ops together.
Uh-huh.
But anyone that would be wired or had any kind of surveillance at all in that kind of op, they'd be killed instantly. We don't tolerate that kind of thing. He even went out under canopy, you know. They're worried about satellites reading your lips and stuff. I mean, these guys are... We're professionals, and we don't allow any kind of surveillance like that at all.
Wow. Satellites reading lips?
Yep.
And what decade was that begun in? 80s, 90s?
I don't know when it was begun, but the satellites have quite good capabilities.
That's extraordinary. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, let me get a quick comment from Ole at this point. Since you've been hearing this story, Ole, what kind of information has come to you? You've got a heck of a network of respect and people around the world. What's been the reaction that you're getting?
The reaction is amazement, and also I can only say that I have not found anything at all that Cody has been lying about. Everything he said has been very accurate, sometimes very emotional, and I can just stand by his side. Not that I know for myself all the details, but I can totally guarantee his serenity or his how sincere he is and honest in his approach of getting the truth out there.
We are, if you just joined us, talking with Cody Snodgrass about the Oklahoma City bombing, a domestic terrorist alleged truck bombing on the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in downtown OKC. That was in 1995, April 19th. And it is a huge story that will forever be talked about and remembered here, no matter how many things continue to happen. And Cody was offered the job, as you just heard. All right, you said no. You turned from an asset to a liability, a long-term asset as well. From you saying you're getting close to the end of your career, and you just wanted nothing to do with it because what was the overriding emotional response that said no to you? What was it?
It's patriotism. I mean, it was our own country, and it was our own people, and there's no way that I would do something like that. I mean, we did a lot of bad things in Black Ops, but that's what I told Harold. It's our own country, and I will not do it. I'm not going to do it. It was patriotic.
Okay, let me ask you a question about Black Ops in general. Deadly Black Ops in specific. What is it about the contractors, independent or on the company payroll, that allows them to knowingly, willfully kill men, women, and children? What is it about them? Are they psychopaths? Are they strictly business? What is it in the makeup or the constitution in people that can do that kind of work? I don't care what country we're talking about here. It's just taking human life.
Yeah, a lot of people are ex-military. That's what they're used on, their ex-military cutouts. Some of them are in the military, mm-hmm. and then they get out, and they're free agents or free assets. Some people do it for money. Some people are, I guess, psychopaths. Some might do it for patriotic reasons.
Uh-huh.
There's a right. Each person has to come up with his own explanation and live with his own things that he does.
Right.
But there's a wide variety of reasons. And some of the things are just actually saving lives. I mean, if someone is about to detonate a suicide bomb in the Middle East somewhere, and you're a sniper doing overwatch, you would certainly kill that individual first before they had a chance to detonate that ordnance and cause
understood.
All kinds of other secondary injuries.
Absolutely understood. Let me ask you another question. As these other terror events have occurred since OKC, and you've been able to, I guess we could say, just sit back and observe to a significant degree. Are you able to see through them pretty quickly, pretty well? When an event happens, like 9/11, all right, how long did it take you to get what happened there, to really get a sense of how it might have been pulled off? You probably had a pretty good instinct, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. I remember that day very, very clearly. I'd been at a guy's house, Captain Glenn Wilson. He did some work for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And he worked with Janet Reno down in Dade County, Florida. He did two tours in Nam. And I was down there at his house after he passed away, helping him clear out a machine gun collection. But I was driving up the pass in Colorado Springs there, coming back home, and I heard it on the news. And I immediately thought, that I didn't believe the story at all, because I don't believe anything in the mainstream media here in America and mm-hmm. other countries. It's general propaganda for the most part. But I just immediately had the feeling that it was something more. And at that point, I hadn't gotten any actionable intelligence or talked to anyone about it. I was not involved in that operation. But mm-hmm. later on, after studying it, I think that they used nanothermites and other things, and they pre-wired those buildings. And then they used, remote-controlled aircraft. I think those aircraft were like drones. And
I agree.
The whole thing was, the whole thing was set up from WCT-7. And you probably saw, Jeff, and I know Ole knows a lot about this, that Building 7 just pancaked straight down.
Sure. Yeah. It was tragically laughable to watch it go down and have people say that it was a result of the rest of the operation. No. And then when you understood that Giuliani's command and control center was in there, and that was evacuated before, you got to start immediately questioning, well, what the hell's going on here? So they ran it out of WTC-7, then they blew up their command post so there would be no traces of the evidence of controlling the demolitions in the towers, which were apparently put together over the better part of a year. And I know William Rodriguez, he said that one floor, and I forget which tower he worked in, there was a whole floor on one of them, probably on both of them, that was shut off. The elevators wouldn't stop there. Stairwells wouldn't open there. You couldn't go there. And yet the people above and below could hear things being moved around on the floor below or the floor above. And that's where they staged the explosives and the whole operation for each tower takedown. I think you've heard the same thing many times.
Right. And yeah, Ole, I'm sure he knows a lot more than I do about that 9/11 thing. That's just amazing, with all the architects that signed the petitions. And the whole thing is, it's so obvious that it was a cover-up. I mean, it's just obvious it was a false flag.
Yeah. And I agree completely with the RC remote control aircraft used, for sure. The planes with people in them were taken to a specific location. I just got a note today from somebody about this one Mossad agent on one of the flights, Daniel Lewin. And I couldn't imagine if, in fact, all the passengers were, let's say, nerve gassed in those planes and killed and then taken out and just dumped. But Lewin, they wouldn't sacrifice one of their own. And I've got word today from somebody that Lewin still has two active email accounts. So there you go. Just got that a few hours ago, and I thank the person who sent it to me. So, yeah, all complicated, very sophisticated. Go ahead, Ole.
No, I just wanted to say that some years ago, my daughter, she was about 6 or 7, I was studying 9/11, and she came and asked me, what are you doing? And I said, I told the official story. And she looked at me and she said, Dad, I'm a child, I'm not stupid. But that's the official story for you.
Oh, that's wow. Well, there's a Damagard for you. Got it in the genes. That's very nice. Well, you should be proud.
Before your mind is messed around with enough so that you believe this type of crap, there's just this normal, what I call Farmer Brown logic. I mean, you cannot dustify a building that size with just a plane.
Well, that's the correct word, too. The building was dustified. One other question on 9/11, then we'll jump off and get back on the main topic. Cody, there is a lot of talk about thermite, nanothermite, and all that. Clearly, there were explosions going off all the way down the sides of those buildings. You can see them if you go slow-mo. Even if you don't, you can still see them. What about shaped nukes to core out the 13 columns in the center? That makes sense? Does that work for you? Small shaped nuclear charges to further dustify the internal structure?
Well, that could have certainly been one modus operandi to pull that off. I have in the appendix to this book that we've written, it's Choosing the Light, Dark Secrets of the Oklahoma City Bombing. But we briefly discussed the 9/11 thing, and I got a copy of a report from Europe where one of the workers had, at 9/11, it was charged with cleaning up, had actually taken some of the molten metal secretly, and he had sent it to some physicists overseas, and they ran the standard X-ray diffraction and gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, and all that high-powered stuff on it, and they found evidence of nanothermite there.
Uh-huh.
And so the nanothermite, what it does is it has a real hot burning characteristic.
Right.
And so if you use a combination of nanothermite with the heat, combined with a very sharp, fast explosion like C4. Which is has a detonation rate of approximately 26,000 feet per second. That
wow.
combination would be enough to sever those main beams, because those twin towers were built to withstand multiple impacts from
yes.
jetliners.
Yes.
And those,
yes.
you know, Jeff, those big main columns in there, those things were huge.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and now nukes could do that, tamped nukes, that certainly could happen, but there'd be the telltale radiation signs later. And if you're going to pull a covert op, what you want to do is minimize blowback. So,
yeah, you don't want radiation laying around to be read. I did have people, though, tell me that there were readings, aberrant readings at Ground Zero days and weeks later. And then you had the issue of the melted cars a couple of blocks away, which at 26,000 feet per second, that's a huge flash of intense heat. I mean, it could be right there. You might not need nukes for that. That's an extraordinary rate of explosivity.
Yeah, that's standard C4, and then they use composition B, which is another less one. And like in the Ryder truck that McVeigh supposedly used with the ammonium nitrate and diesel,
yeah.
Each explosive that you use has a characteristic waveform, and it's called a spherical wave divergence. And some of them, the compression waves are not, in the case of diesel or composition B, those compression waves are not sufficient to cut steel. Only the high, fast uh-huh. explosive rates like C4, that's the only thing combined with nanothermite that would actually cut those very big steel beams.
Yeah, well, they were cut like wet noodles, apparently. We're going to take a break for a couple of minutes, gentlemen. We'll come right back. Cody, what I'd like you to do, and Todd, I want you to call Cody right back. Let's see if we can get that very slight buzz off the line. So hang up, Cody. We're going to call you right back, and we will be right back in just a few minutes. Okay, let's get right back to our very special program tonight. Ole Damgaard is with us, and our special guest, courtesy of Ole, is independent black ops contractor Cody Snodgrass, who has retired, was at it a long time, and knows a lot of different things. And what we have is a story that may sound implausible to some of you, but in this day and age, not much does anymore. Cody was offered $1 million to blow the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. And this was done, if you didn't hear it, out in the middle of a forest or a wooded area. The offer was made. Somebody had a backpack with $500,000 cash. The other $500,000 was due on completion of the job. And Cody said no. No thank you. And that turned him into an immediate liability. And we know that the intel people don't like liabilities. So what happened next, Cody?
Well, after I turned that job down, there was about 6 more months. And by 1995, in March, I had my retirement party. And I made up my mind I'd never go back to that kind of stuff. And
right.
I wanted to kind of turn my life around and get back to the light more. And so then in April 19th, 1995, the building went off. And when it did, I immediately went black, so to speak. We had false IDs and, disguises and so forth. And we had had a network. I used to be a geophysicist for Amoco Production Company in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But we were running black ops over in Arkansas in the early 80s, 82, 83, 84, 85. One of the ops was Centaur Rose was the code name, you know, Rose for the Rose Law Firm.
Oh, I was going to ask you if this had anything to do with Clinton's or Rose. Well,
yeah, it did. There were three ops there, Centaur Rose and Jade Bridge and Screw Worm. And back in 84, Congress had passed the Boland Amendment after Senator Boland, and which forbade us to be militarily involved down in the conflict in Nicaragua where the Soviets were supplying the Sandinista communists there with Daniel Ortega, who was the president. And, of course, we were supporting the Contras. So President Ronald Reagan at the time, he wanted to keep the balance of power there. And he secretly ordered CIA director to conduct those operations to arm the Contras and keep the Soviets from taking over the rest of Central America. So,
and that's what that was the goal, by the way, for those of you listening. The Soviets were after all of Central America. They wanted the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. And so, anyway, they had the ops there in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was governor. And the Centaur Rose op was the one where arms were taken down there to covertly arm the Contras. And then the drugs were brought back, cocaine, to pay for the op because they couldn't, you know, this was an illegal domestic op, and they couldn't go to Congress for money. So that's how they funded it. In the meanwhile, I was a geophysicist over there, and we were working in that op. And we had a network of, you know, safe houses and so forth there. And the guys I was working with had worked for the CIA in the Vietnam War. And so anyway, after the Murrah Building went off, I went down there to our series of safe houses, and I hid out for a while. I was afraid they were going to kill me because I knew about the op and turned it down, and I was a liability.
Cody, and a question, please.
Yeah.
Excuse me for the interruption.
No,
the safe houses couldn't have been run by the people who would have tried to kill you. Who put these safe houses? I don't want names, but I mean, in general, how did these safe houses come to be? And were they actually safe from the black ops machines that you were worried about?
These guys were really good for Vietnam. They'd been in a lot of ops over there, and then they came back to the States, and they were working in the ops over in Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the safe houses consisted of farms, and, you know, one had an airstrip. And
so they set them up independently of the government or the intel agency community, all that. They needed their own place to go. So like a group did this for their own self-protection.
Well, obviously. Sure. Any time you're running a black op, you know, the less knowledge about anything, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of black operators don't even trust anybody. I mean, if they're on a sanctions TI op, a lot of times they won't trust any of the own guys that are with them because there's always intelligence leaks, things can happen. So they always set up things for themselves usually that no one knows about,
uh-huh.
No one can trace, and it's a safe house. It's a place where you can go and be safe from all the long reach of the black community.
Got it. Very good. Well, you answered the question perfectly. Thank you for that. Okay, so you went to ground. You went to safe house after the Murrah blast. You knew there were going to be trouble. How long did you have to hang out?
I actually left the country after that for a while. We had false passports and stuff, and I stayed here in Oklahoma for a number of months, and then I disappeared for a while, and then came back up to the States later after things had cooled off. By that time, they had indicted Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols for the bombing. They were actually the patsies.
They had their patsies. Yeah, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, like you said before, the bomb, the building was pre-wired, and those bombs were there already installed and by another black ops team. And McVeigh was the patsy with the Ryder truck. And when he was going to pull up at about 9 a.m. on April 19th, 1995, he was going to detonate that bomb, and that was the cover for the op. In other words, Jeff, when an op like that goes off, it's going to be very public. There's going to be a lot of press, a lot of firefighters and people. And so when you have a very public op like that, you have to have a cover for that op. And the cover was the Ryder truck that was going to detonate and be the, you know, the Patsy and the lone bomber to cover up the fact that that building, they were going to be detonated simultaneously. But what happened, two of the bombs didn't go off. And that black police officer you're talking about, you couldn't remember his name earlier, his name was Randy Yeeke, and he had been a MP before in the military.
That's right. Yeah.
And he got out and was working for the Oklahoma City Police Department. And he was actually the first responder. He was down on Northwest 5th Street in downtown Oklahoma City in his patrol car, and he'd stopped someone on a regular traffic stop, was given a ticket, and when that bomb went off about 9:02, 9:03 a.m., and then he went running, and he was the first one in that building, and, you know, with the glass and all of the lacerations and stuff, there was a lot of people, a lot of stuff going on, and he rescued four people that were bleeding, and he won the Oklahoma City Police Department's Meritorious Conduct Award for saving civilians. And then during the course of that, he went in a daycare center trying to find some children and help them, and he discovered those unexploded bombs, one of them. And so they didn't detonate all the way, and so now they had another cover-up they had to do. So.
Yeah, now that's a very interesting thing. Thank you for bringing that out. I heard that early on, and that story disappeared real fast. So he saw the bomb. I wonder where the bombs were placed in near the nursery, probably in the debris and the wreckage he could see around corners or through false walls that he shouldn't otherwise be able to see through. And he saw that. He must have known what he was looking for.
Well, yeah, he'd been in the military, and when he saw that unexploded bomb in the daycare,
yeah,
he immediately began to know that there was something fishy going on.
Oh yeah,
and when you're doing any kind of terrorist that do operations and blow buildings and stuff, they always consider the psyops, the psychological effect on the civilian population in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so the daycare bomb, if it didn't have any structural reason to be there, you know, like the beams in the building, the main reason to put the bomb in daycare is because they wanted children casually so that they could use the emotional appeal. That's what terrorists do. They try to cause maximum carnage and maximum damage to get the biggest emotional response. I mean, it's a horrendous thing, but that's how these satanic people think.
The black police officer in the nursery, and the idea was that nursery was supposed to be obliterated and all the children gone, just wiped out. Was the entire building supposed to drop? Was that supposed to be part of the game?
Yes, absolutely. There were three main charges. They were all supposed to detonate simultaneously at the same time that Timothy McVeigh was going to set off that Ryder truck.
Right.
But McVeigh didn't know that those black operators in there, you know, they had two ops. He was supposed to pull up there and do that, and then the guys on the inside had their own thing. And McVeigh was the cover. He was the patsy. When they offered me that job, I immediately knew it was a patsy job, because $1 million, I wouldn't even consider doing an operation like that for that kind of money. That's ridiculous. And I knew it was a patsy, and I was fixing to retire, so they killed two birds with one stone.
Oh, so you figured out that you were being set up for a potential patsy at that low of a price.
Absolutely. I knew it was a patsy job right off the bat, and then I was fixing to retire in a few months. And that way they kill two birds with one stone, and they shut me up, and I'm the patsy, and I'm no longer a liability. And so anyway, Randy Yeeke found that bomb, and he began his own investigation. And over the years, he interviewed a lot of witnesses and talked to a lot of people, and he collected about 9 file boxes of various forms of evidence about that. And he was warned off by his commanders in the Oklahoma City Police Department to not pursue this. The FBI offered him a cush job in Dallas to, you know, stop what he was doing. And he was a patriot, like me. And eventually, Randy Yeeke he fell into quite disfavor, and they just flat out threatened him and said, you need to stop this stuff. And he had another friend that he made copies with of those records. And he was getting scared towards the end. And they took another copy of the records and they put them in a safe deposit box in one of the banks downtown there. And so one day he told his wife, Tanya, he said, I'm going to take all this stuff out of here. I'm getting nervous. And he went up to Kingfisher, Oklahoma, and he had them in his patrol car. And then he was going to put them in a storage room. And a little while later, after he had lunch there, this was on May the 8th of 1996, there was a patrolman. He was a Canadian County Deputy Sheriff. His name was Mike Ramsey. And he was out driving around doing his normal driving around one of the prisons up there, checking for inmates and stuff. And he found Yankee's car sitting out there by a field, and the trunk was open, the door was open, and he pulled up on it, and it was covered with blood. And he called it all in, and about 40 or so law enforcement officers all descended on the area. There was State Highway Patrol, Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation, Canadian County deputies. They all looked, and they found Randy Yeakey's body. He was quite a ways from the car, and he had been cut up. He had multiple cuts all over him, contusions. He had been beaten, and he'd also been shot in the back of the head. And so they looked around for his service revolver. His pistol was gone, and they looked for it and couldn't find it. And so after close to an hour of all these police officers wandering around trying to find the gun, I mean, there was a gunshot to the head, then a black helicopter came out of the FBI office in Oklahoma City, and in that chopper was the FBI's SAC. That's the Strategic Area Commander. His name was Bob Ricks. And there was a couple other guys with him in that chopper. And when they were there for about 5 or 10 minutes, all of a sudden they found the gun. After 40 or more trained police officers had looked for almost an hour.
Got it. Yeah, I understand. Gotcha.
Okay. So Yankee had died. And then the guy that he had given the other copy of the files to, his name, I believe, was Ron. I've got it in the book. I got all the details in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was Dr. Don Chumley, that was his name. Anyway, he had a single-engine civilian aircraft, and he was taking those files somewhere to put them up, and his plane crashed exactly the same day on May the 8th, 1996. So, Tanya Yeakey, his wife, was the only one that knew where the other files were in the safety deposit box.
Uh-huh.
And by then, the police had called her and told her husband was found dead, so she went down to the bank building to retrieve the files, and the woman there told her that the FBI had just been there and taken those files under national security. These were all of Randy Yeakey's records that he'd been. He was the one that first saw that bomb there. He was the first responder, and he got real suspicious. He knew there was a cover-up, so he started trying to document it, and now all the records, everything, vanished into the black hole.
Well, we must honor Randy, and I'm glad you were able to fill in all those blanks. Another great American, sacrificed. Sorry to hear it. Is his wife still alive?
Well, what happened to Tanya after that, she realized that there was something big going on. And when she got back home, someone had broken her house, and they had wrote some threatening things on the wall. I can't remember. It's in the book exactly what it was.
Right.
Something like, you're next or something. And so she went to stay with her sister. And then a couple of weeks later, her car, she was driving it, and the brakes failed on it. And she was doing about 40 miles an hour, and she managed to get it under control. And they took it into a shop there, a local shop, and they had it inspected.
Uh-huh.
And they said that someone had tampered with the brake lines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. Same old. They just kill off everybody who's a liability, as you said in the very beginning.
Well, that's, Jeff, that's how they do on a standard black op. If if they call it blowback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a true black op stays only the black operators that do it and the principals that hire it out, they're the ones that know about it. But if something sours up, like in the Murr building, that the two bombs did not explode, and so now you have a bunch of blowback, and you have to start covering it up, and that's what they did with the witness. They control the blowback.
Wow. Foley, anything you want to add at this point?
Could I just go back to 9/11 just quickly and say that I think it's a mistake to think that there's so many wants to, like, was it controlled demolition? Was it mini nukes? Was it directed energy weapons? The answer is yes, it was all of it, because the buildings had to come down. It was the first time they ever aimed at the buildings that size. And so they were using all the hidden artillery, everything, to get these buildings down because...
Oh, we lost Ole. All right. Are you there, Cody?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I will get him back in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, that's that overseas Skype connection or something.
Yeah, that's where the buzzing was coming from. I could tell now. So maybe we'll reconnect. Very slight buzzing in the background. All right, we have just about less than a minute to go before we have to take a break here. We'll come back and pick up the major story. I want all of you to pay really close attention to this. This is a classic operation that didn't go according to plan. Most of them, or many of them, do, of course, and we never have a chance to find out anything like this. This Ryder truck and McVeigh... You keep that in mind. I'm sure most of you listening are well familiar with this, at least in a superficial way. We're going to fill it out in our next hour as we continue with Ole Damgaard and Cody Snodgrass in just a couple minutes, so hang on.